Viscount Carmichael, Mr. Gonzalez, Mr. Romney. It's very pleasant to be here this morning and to have this opportunity of talking to you again. In the great Niagara frontier, in which I have the privilege to live, we are famous, among other things, for the invention of the cocktail. It was there in the Niagara frontier that Betsy Flanagan, during the War of 1812, mixed the first cocktail. But so many times the inventors of things don't profit by the exploitation. And I may assure all of you that after 3 days of painful personal research, I can say that the District of Columbia has exploited the cocktail to the ultimate. I enjoyed what Mr. Romney had to say tremendously. I thought it was a very sensible and straightforward presentation. However, I know he would like me to make one small correction, because he told us this morning in regard to Mexico that it was Pancho Villa, the bandit, who chased him out. And I submit that this early experience of his youth proved to be of great profit in connection with some of the people with whom he has to deal all the time. Some time ago, we had at the University of Buffalo a convocation, the purpose of which was to attempt to peer ahead some 40 to 50 years from the viewpoint of the mid-century and see what the America of 40 to 50 years from now might be. And included in the panels presented, and of course you know why they always say a board of directors is a board and a group such as this is a panel. A board is long, narrow, and wooden, and a panel is polished and very decorative. We had a panel of very prominent businessmen whose job it was to survey the American business scene of the mid-century and look ahead to 40 or 50 years from now and see what was likely to happen to Americans. And the moderator who introduced that panel gave a description of the American businessman, which I think is well worth repeating. He said the mid-century American businessman needs the 100 heads of Hydra and the multiple arms of Vishnu. He must be in not only two, but in three or four places at one time. It is required that he be a production genius, a financial wizard, a super salesman, a civic leader, and a diplomat. He is expected to be an expert on all governmental rules and regulations and a swami on the future course of business. His spare time, if any, may be spent in maintaining reasonably good contacts with his family and making out his income tax return. If that description of a mid-century businessman doesn't strike a responsive chord with you, I know that certainly it will with your wife and your family. My job this morning is to get you interested in flexing your political muscles. And I use political muscles very, very definitely, specifically. I remember when I first came out to New York State 30 years ago, and if you think I talk funny now, you should have heard me then. You know, we always say that Boston is still the hub of the universe, and it's not our fault if the rim has gotten off center. We're sort of subdued Texans with a broad A. But when I first came out to New York State, I was in the small community of Geneva, and I think this is as good a point of departure as any. There was a service club there that decided there should be a close rapprochement between the farmers and the people in the city, and so they gave a meeting to which they invited the farmers of the surrounding towns. And there was a professor of psychology at Hobart College who delivered the talk on the occasion, and then after the meeting he went out like a country preacher and stood at the front door and shook hands with everyone as he went out, saying to each, "You're a businessman, you're a farmer, you're a businessman, you're a farmer." And sure enough, he didn't miss one single pick. He was 100% right. So I cornered him and said, "Professor, by what trick of psychology did you pick out the businessmen from the farmers?" He says, "It's no trick at all. It's just employing the obvious. You see, the farmers have their calluses on their hands." Well, my function on this program today is to get you to get some calluses on your political hands. In every community across this whole broad land, whenever there's a civic job to be done, when there's great civic good to be accomplished, when there is something that takes tremendous organization, always the community turns to business for its leadership. And that has become so general and so accepted on the part of businessmen that everybody today realizes that's a part of his job. He must carry along this burden. And so the great American corporations, on, as we've heard just a few moments ago, on top of the millions of dollars that they contribute to charitable and philanthropic enterprises, they heap on top of that millions of dollars worth of high-priced man-hours providing this leadership. That is as true of the individual small business as it is of the great corporation. Every businessman knows that a part of his job is to carry that civic burden. Now, businessmen not always had the respect which is usually accorded them in this country. In medieval society, the people who were engaged in trade were looked down on by the aristocracy and kept in the social deep freeze. The aristocracy themselves contributed nothing but intrigue and war, which went by the engaging name of chivalry, but nonetheless, they felt that the tradesman was to be frozen in a frozen society. And so that primitive businessman passed his business to his son, and his son passed his business on beyond that, and always, always, always there he was. And that was characteristic of the medieval society of Europe. But our country made a great break with that. We were much more interested in knowing what a man could do. We were interested in knowing what his judgment was, how trustworthy it was, and how moral and how straightforward he was, and how much courage he had. With a country to settle and a continent to conquer, we couldn't stop and look up in Burke's Peerage or the Social Register to determine who would be the leader. We chose someone who could do it, and it's never been recounted that Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett was ever listed in the Social Register. We've always gone on the measure of ability. What can a man do? And he rises in proportion to what he can do. Now here's this businessman, with all these talents to which I've referred, with all these abilities, an aggressive man in his business, ready to stand forth and battle for business, sometimes working too hard at it, I think. Why is he so quiet when politics is mentioned? What's the matter with him? I'm going to talk about the participation of the businessman in politics. Not in government, in politics. Because I believe that in our kind of a government, politics is going to enter more and more and more into your life, whether you enter more and more and more into politics or not. Politics is the art of government. It's the art of running your affairs. And it seems to me that the businessman has no need to be such a shrinking wallflower if he is able to run all these various enterprises that he does run. He has no need to be a shrinking wallflower when it comes to a question of political activity. Each man and woman in this room is a stockholder in the United States of America, in the state where he lives, and in the community where he lives. Now, whatever else you may hold in your portfolio, if you lose the confidence of management, in management, you can sell out, you can get out, and you can give them a vote of no confidence by putting them on the auction block. But you cannot sell out the stock that you own in your government. It's yours for life, and you must pass it along to all those who come after you. It isn't a condition where you can get out. Our government presupposes that there will be participation by all citizens. That means the businessman, as well as everyone else. And as you recall, the old bromide is that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. If that be true, then the perennial political promise to give, quote, a good business-like administration, unquote, is about as high an endorsement of the businessman in government and in politics as there can be. Now, there's a basic difference, of course, between the way you operate a business and the way you operate government. Government forecasts a deficit and then decides how to whack that deficit up among the taxpayers in proportion to their ability to pay. Business goes at it with a contrary point of view and forecasts a profit and decides how to whack that profit up, if any can be smuggled down to surplus, among the stockholders in proportion to their investment. So you have a difference in thinking, a red ink thinking and a black ink thinking. And it seems to me that the black ink thinking of business is an excellent counterpoise for the red ink thinking of government. More political businessmen may give us more business-like politicians. A friend of mine in public office once said to me, "You're a fortunate fellow as a corporate officer that you don't have to face an electorate every 2 or 4 years. I said, "My dear fellow, every corporate officer that there is faces an electorate and a very discerning one every business day when that bell rings on the stock exchange. Their vote, these discerning members of the electorate, by whether they buy or they sell his securities, they there vote their confidence or lack of confidence every business day. So we, in reality, are elected some 250 or 60 days a year facing that very discerning electorate. And we don't have to hire public opinion pollsters to tell us how we're doing, because the results of our public poll are shown in every American newspaper with the closing prices every night." I think there is all over American industry, a growing awareness of the thing that's called political climate and its importance. There is one industry which urges its managers, its plant managers, to be more than good paper shufflers and metal cutters, pointing out that they have a citizen responsibility. I don't think there's a single chamber of commerce represented here that hasn't at one time or another attempted to secure an industrial plant. The national press is full of advertisements from all over the country urging this site or that site or the other site. And many times, not enough consideration is given to this factor of political climate. Have you assessed the political climate of your town, your state, your country, to see whether it's attractive to business? Everybody knows that business makes jobs and jobs make people economically well off. I bet there are 100 corporation executives in this room this morning who could rise and testify that at least one plant location they were considering was abandoned because of an adverse political climate. Now, I'm not talking about giving subsidy to industry in order to get a plant. Any industry worth its salt will bear its full share as a taxpayer. I'm not talking about that at all. I am talking about such things as profligate public spending and a lack of public facilities as a result. I'm talking about a one-sided interpretation of labor laws which puts all the burden on industry and becomes expensive. I'm talking about an irresponsibility in public office. And I suggest that if you are interested in an industrial location, that you assess this question of political climate in your town. Now, you must think by now that I'm trying to encourage all of you to go home and immediately run for mayor or run for governor or run for the House of Representatives. It's not that at all. I am merely urging your interest in politics directly, and the machinery is available to you. It's available in the more than 2,500 national affairs, governmental affairs committees of chambers of commerce, and if yours doesn't have one, it had better establish one as quickly as possible. That machinery is available to reflect your opinion and make you an effective citizen rather than an ineffective resident. And in my judgment, with that available, you certainly should employ it. Now, businessmen have no time. I know that. That's always been their complaint, that I haven't the time for it. I haven't the time for it. I merely say to you that your country's business is of the first importance. There was a fine group of young men back in 1940 who had other business, and important business. The business of getting married and raising families and the business of establishing themselves in their families. But their country's business came along and they had to lay it aside. I say to you that as businessmen, this is what deserves your very first consideration. We're all concerned with the worldwide drift to socialism. The American people, in my judgment, if given the opportunity, would vote socialism down resoundingly, a complete socialistic program. But unfortunately, the issue is never as cleanly cut as that. It creeps up to you. I think I said when I was here before that the experience of history is that you're not suddenly clapped into irons. You're bound by a rope of silk which is passed around you one thread at a time until eventually you have a rope which is so tight that it's much more effective than iron bands. The issue is not drawn clearly. The issue is usually a creeping in, and socialism always creeps completely in at the end. There's no way of halting it in the middle. And so it seems to me that we must realize that socialism is being presented piecemeal to the whole world, including us, rather than in a clear-cut issue. There was a very aristocratic Frenchman who once wrote a book. Would that mine enemy would write a book. But he wrote this in 1839, and I was not to be born for 5 years thereafter. And I agree with him. He discussed the rise of tyranny in Russia under the Tsars. And he said one thing which I think should make interesting reading to present-day Americans, the Marquis de Custine. The Tsars have taught us that despotism is never so fearsome as when it claims to be doing good, for then it assumes the right to explain away its most revolting acts by its good intentions, and to offer ills endlessly in the guise of remedies. Overt crime can triumph only for a day. It is sham virtues which forever mislead the minds of men. The issues are not always clear. They creep upon you. Now, of course, taxes is perhaps the best and broadest road to socialism, because as I suspect this picture will point out, when taxes get so high that private thrift is impossible, capital formation is inhibited, and when that happens, the government comes forward as the capitalist, and that's National Socialism. It's a very pleasant experience, but devastating at the end. Because when you reach that state, the high taxes are merely saying, we know how to spend your money better than you do. So we'll spend it for what we think is right, and we won't let you spend it for what you think is right. And my friends, that is fiscal despotism, the blood brother of political despotism. There were some figures recently that I think will interest you. Taking a family with an income of $6,000 and two children, $1 out of each four that family spent was spent for taxes. Now we hear about the high cost of living, but the high cost of government is an element in the high cost of living. Because in the budget of this family, which was typical, only union dues, hospitalization, and gifts to church and charity were exempt. Everything else bore a tax burden, and 25% of their cost of living with their two children was the cost of government. Now, finally, I always like to remind people of this because sometimes I think we forget it. The roots of our free enterprise system go back to the roots of our original belief. And the belief of the Judeo-Christian society which we have in the West lie in the concept that God is the master of man and therefore the state can never be. As long as man holds that notion close in his head and in his heart, he will be free. If it can be taken out by propaganda, by repression, he will lose his freedom no matter what form he employs, because it is a basic belief. We believe, fundamentally, that man is the inheritor of a certain bundle of rights from Almighty God, and that no one may take those rights away from him. No temporal power may take them. That's our basic belief. In our economic system, we translate that into the ability, the inherent right of anyone to proceed his own merry way as long as he does not violate the bounds of good taste and the reasonable limits set up by society. We take the point of view that the government, and has been stated so many times, that the government should never do anything for its citizens that they are ready, able, and willing to do for themselves. But it isn't enough to believe. It isn't enough, as Mr. Romney said, to show the products thereof. In our kind of a government, that must be made effective. And that means a participation by you actively in politics. We began with the aphorism that the businessman is busy. Then we proceeded to outline another big job for him, which is customary at a meeting of this kind. But if our kind of a government is to be preserved, our concern for our country must be at least equivalent of the men who many years ago were willing to make every sacrifice in order to secure the blessings of liberty to themselves and their posterity. They were busy, too, with their own affairs. But they found time to fight for the right as they saw it to be the right. Rousseau said some 200 years ago this, which I would like to leave with you. As soon as public service ceases to be the chief business of the citizens, and they would rather serve with their money than with their persons, the state is not far from its fall. Good laws lead to the making of better ones. Bad ones bring about worse. As soon as any man says of the affairs of state, what does it matter to me? The state may be given up for lost. It's been very pleasant to talk to you. Thank you.